We shouldn't forget that this was a full-on massacre of peaceful protesters that occurred.
Today marks 30 years since a peaceful student-led movement was brutally ended by Chinese government troops. It's Tuesday, June 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on VOA Asia Facebook for more on today's special program. Also ahead, a top student leader recalls his perspective of events leading to June 4th, 1989. Tiananmen survivors tell their stories. We hear from the photographer of the iconic Tank Man image and skirting suppression by keeping Tiananmen stories alive. It's all on today's VOA Asia. 30 years ago, student-led pro-democracy protests centered on Beijing's Tiananmen Square, with corruption among the elite a key complaint among demonstrators. Protesters also called for political reforms and a fairer and more open society. Human rights groups believe several hundred to several thousand people were killed when tanks rolled through Tiananmen Square to squelch the demonstrations. State Department spokesperson Morgan Ortegas told VOA during a press briefing that the United States continues to mark and condemn the 1989 incident.
We shouldn't forget that this was a full-on massacre of peaceful protesters that occurred. We remember the tragic loss of innocent lives, and as we do every year, and we will again this year, express our deep sorrow to the families who are still grieving.
Ortegas added, "We want those released who have been jailed for striving to keep the memory of Tiananmen Square alive and an end to continued harassment of demonstration participants and their families."
The U.S. Has called for, and we will continue to call for, as have others in the international community, a full public accounting for those killed, detained, and missing.
According to Amnesty International, over recent weeks, police in China have detained, placed under house arrest, or threatened dozens of activists who are seeking to mark the anniversary, as well as relatives of those killed. Jeffrey Wasserstrom is professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. Wasserstrom's research interests began with the role of student protests and have grown to include the social history of China and comparative social history. He explains the buildup to the June 4th crackdown.
I think one thing that's significant looking back is that the fact that there was a crackdown wasn't really what seemed so surprising at the time. What seemed surprising was how long it took for the government to take decisive actions. And I think that division at the top is a key part of things. One is that in a lot of ways the protests were simply calling on the Communist Party to live up to its own professed ideals. And there could be some resonance of that among Communist Party officials at the time. There was probably a hope on the part of the leadership that this would just fizzle out, that this would dissipate. And then there was also a hope, I think, when they brought out this harsh editorial April 26th condemning the protesters and saying that the protesters were creating turmoil, a kind of code word for the kind of chaos that was associated with the Cultural Revolution period that nobody really wanted to go back to, that the protesters would just leave. But in fact, that editorial just angered a lot of people who saw what was going on in the streets not as turmoil and chaos, but as simple demands for change that were acceptable. And so a series of moves that the government made that they thought would tamp down the protests actually served to rev them up. So there were a variety of factors going on there.
The government in Beijing moved very quickly to distance itself from the events of June 4th. In fact, pretty much tried to erase that from the public memory. And one of the amazing outcomes of the events then is that they were highly successful in doing so. Why is the government still so fearful of what happened that day?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I do think the whole phenomenon of this effort to put a state of amnesia on the events. I mean, I do think that what the Communist Party keeps saying is, look how far we've come. Look how far we've come. Look at how strong China is in the world. Look at the booming economy. Look at the spectacle of the Olympics. And I think it goes along with the forced amnesia, because it's an effort to keep people distracted and focusing on different things, so that even if they get an inkling of the messiness that the government was involved with, that maybe this will discourage them from pushing too hard, trying too hard to find out more. And anything that the Western press has gotten wrong then or since is exploited to say, well, they got that wrong, so maybe they're lying about everything. So even though there's enormous proof of a vicious crackdown, these different factors working together have been disturbingly successful within the mainland because there is so much control over the media communication.
Jeffrey Wasserstrom, professor of history at the University of California, Irvine. Coming up, the perspective from inside the student-led pro-democracy movement as we hear from one of its top leaders. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now when you go to voanews.com. U.S. salutes heroes of Tiananmen Square protests killed by Chinese soldiers. Photographer shares long-hidden photos of Tiananmen protests. Pompeo urges China to release human rights prisoners to mark Tiananmen crackdown. China warns students about study in the United States. Asian countries fear being forced to choose between China and the United States over disputed sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. To provide some perspective about what happened at Tiananmen Square in 1989, I spoke with one of the top four student leaders of that movement, Shen Tong.
I was a student back in 1989, a third-year student at Beijing University. When I was involved in the student movement since 86, but when the spring of 1989 started, I was first elected as the student autonomous union in Beida, Peking University, and then later on become early organizer of what's known as a dialogue delegation, one of the three main umbrella student organizations. Our main responsibility was to negotiate with the government on behalf of the demonstrators.
A lot of us focus on the anniversary of June 4th. This actually began quite some time before that. What was the genesis of the student movement?
It was a build-up since, more specifically, the mid-80s, but more broadly defined, ever since the start of the open door and reform policy in the end of 1970s, a couple of years after Mao's death. But more specifically, since 1985, 86, there's waves of national student movement, generally calling for broader reform and end of official corruption. But specifically, on April 15th, 1989, the sudden death of the former communist chief Hu Yaobang was a surprise to the students. Students generally felt he was ousted because of the student movement back in 1986. So his death sparked a wave of commemoration that was curiously suppressed by the hardliners at the time. So that suppression was actually further triggered a broader dissent and protest.
How did the movement gather such growth so that it came to Tiananmen Square?
Well, it's a moment. It was more a moment than a movement. It's very similar to, say, Occupy Wall Street last fall, where it really tapped into a national psyche it's known as a movement or a moment of rising expectations. Things were generally getting better in some significant ways to people's daily life in China, but the perceived and the sudden inequality and very visible official corruptions made people edgy, if not dissatisfied. So the student protests quickly turned into a broader call of government accountability and of official corruption that really tapped into that national psyche at the time.
Did you get a sense that there was something coming?
It's one of those things that the day before you think it's impossible, the day after you become inevitable. So in some larger sense, I would say nobody predicted that. But then as the event took off, as the moment actually was upon us, all these factors before that seems leading to that inevitability.
Did China miss an opportunity because of this?
Absolutely. I think it's not just China, because it's both symbolic and real influence in the world affairs. It actually, the world missed a major opportunity. The world history would have been different if the events of the spring of 1989 turned out differently. And there's every possibility that it could have had a different result, that the massacre wasn't inevitable. China could have gone onto a more balanced development instead of embracing this unbalanced full embrace of materialism, which now eventually led to the breakdown of moral, if not social, fabrics in China.
Shen Tong, a top student leader in the democracy movement at Tiananmen Square 30 years ago today. Also in 1989, Shen Tong was named one of the People of the Year by Newsweek magazine. He is now a media and software entrepreneur. Happening now in Asia, the Chinese Ministry of Education has warned Chinese students about studying in the United States, referencing an increase in delays and further complications regarding visa processing. The warning comes during a protracted trade war and heightened tensions between China and the United States. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad to have you with us today on our special edition of VOA Asia. 30 years after a bloody crackdown by the Chinese government on a student-led pro-democracy movement, student leaders and activists of the movement attended a recent conference in a Washington, D.C. suburb, where they talked about what happened in Beijing's Tiananmen Square and why. VOA's Xiaoyu and Hailun filed this report, narrated by Anna Cook.
On the night of June 3, 1989, crowds gathered on Tiananmen Square in the center of Beijing. Among them was Yan Jiaqi, then director of the Political Research Institute of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences.
Later, I realized at that moment shots had already been fired, but the hundreds of thousands of people at Tiananmen Square didn't see what was coming at them.
Armed troops and military vehicles advanced toward the protesters on Tiananmen Square from different directions outside the city. Those in the square had no idea what was approaching them. And around midnight, Yan returned home.
As I fell asleep around 1 or 2 a.m., I suddenly heard loud gunshots that sounded just like firecrackers. But the sound was much louder and sharper. We ran toward the balcony to take a look. Our balcony was on the east side of the alley where you could see East Chang'an Street. We saw a lot of flashes and tense ones. At that time, I knew they had opened fire, and I thought China had really changed.
That evening, along dimly lit streets, journalist Wang Juntao watched soldiers fire relentlessly on the crowd.
People attacked a few vehicles with bricks, marching forward, screaming, one, two, three. They stood together. Those bricks struck like raindrops. And as the bricks were thrown, the soldiers continued to fire.
Wang, who spoke recently at a forum in a Washington suburb along with other Tiananmen survivors, said some memories are still vivid 30 years later.
I saw for the first time a human die with eyes still wide open. His face was looking up at the sky, and his head was streaming down with blood. My head felt numb. It occurred to me that day was going to remain as a solemn day in China's history. China's politics was taking a huge step backwards.
On the night of June 3rd, when Peking University student Wang Dan heard that troops had opened fire, his initial reaction was disbelief.
Students called each other to spread the news that the government troops had opened fire at protesters. When the calls first came in, I still didn't believe what was said. But later, as calls increased, I realized it must be true. For two or three days, I had absolutely no thoughts because, you know, your brain turns numb with big shocks.
Yan Jiaqi says the government's inability to own up to what happened that night continues to hold the country back.
What happened on June 4th, 1989 needs to be corrected to all of China as a massacre, an act of crime on the people executed by the Communist Party. China as a country will never move forward if the truth about June 4th, 1989 is not told. Without justice, China will have no future.
Talk of Tiananmen remains heavily censored in China, where the bloody crackdown is still referred to by the government as a counter-revolutionary riot. For Xiaoyu and Hailun, this is Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, an iconic Tiananmen photo that almost never happened. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA programs. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia, a Chinese state-run daily defended the government's handling of the Tiananmen protests, saying it immunized China against turmoil in a rare editorial about the crackdown on the eve of its 30th anniversary. The Global Times English language edition hailed the Chinese government's handling of what it called the incident. Find more on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, perhaps the most iconic image from 30 years ago at Tiananmen Square was that of a Chinese man standing in the middle of the street, halting the progression of several army tanks. The identity of the man and his eventual fate remain unknown to this day. We do know who took the photograph. American Jeff Widener, who was working for the Associated Press. He shared with me his story of taking that photo and about the many obstacles that could have prevented the world from ever seeing it.
My job was to go to Tiananmen Square every morning and photograph the activities. And it was, a very jovial experience, almost like a carnival atmosphere. Everybody was celebrating this new freedom that they had. On the night of June 4th, I went out, and things started really getting pretty heavy. There was a burning armored car, and I lifted the camera to my eye. At the second, a large brick hit me in the face. The camera absorbed the blow. Fortunately, it saved my life. And then I had to get back to the AP office and file. I didn't go back out. I was just too scared. I was sick. I had a massive concussion. So I drew the small straw again, and it was my job to go to the Beijing Hotel, which had the closest vantage point. And I got there, and I had to get past secret police who were using electric cattle prods on the journalist. Fortunately, one young college kid from America named Kirk Martson, he managed to smuggle me up into his room, and that's where I made the tank man photograph.
This must have been an absolutely astounding scene that was playing out before your eyes as you're watching this lone gentleman walk out into the street in front of a line of tanks.
It was and it wasn't, because you have to remember I had a massive concussion. I was really spaced out, and nothing was really making a lot of sense to me. So seeing a guy walking out in the middle of a boulevard with shopping bags and confronting tanks just seemed par for the course. When I saw the tanks coming down the street, I lined up my 400-millimeter lens, and I thought, well, you know, it's a nice shot. And the guy walks out, and the first thing I said, well, this guy's going to screw up my composition. And then Kirk's screaming, they're going to kill him, they're going to kill him. And so, you know, I looked at this guy just waiting for the instant he was going to be, you know, shot. But nothing happened, you know, and he's just still there, standing there. And so I realized the picture was too far away, and I looked back at the bed where I had a lens doubler. This would increase my focal length to 800 millimeter. So the situation was, do I gamble and maybe miss the shot completely, or do I go and try to increase the magnification to get a better picture? Well, I did that, and I took three frames, and I realized something was wrong with my camera setting. The shutter speed was too slow. And by that time, Tank Man was taken away. It was an error I made on the sensitivity of the film, but fortunately one picture came out.
How were you able to get your film out of there with so much security in the hotel?
Well, thank God for Kirk Martson, because he was instrumental in not only getting me to the roof, but he also helped me with getting the film past the secret police. You know, he just looked like a college student. He had short pants on, sandals, a dirty Rambo T-shirt. You know, he just looked like, you know, a young kid. And so he smuggled all my film into his shorts. He goes all the way down to the looking for the AP office, can't find it, is smart enough to think about going to the American Embassy, tells them it's very important film and it needs to go to AP. Fortunately, the American Embassy did that. They transferred the film over to the office, and it was transmitted to the rest of the world, and that's how it was done. Mm. And he really risked his life doing that. The other thing that's interesting about that is that because we were so busy, the chemicals were not refreshed properly. So the tank man negative actually started disintegrating almost immediately. Unfortunately, AP managed to preserve it long enough digitally before it completely disintegrated. And right now, it basically the negative is just gone completely.
And there's yet another interesting caveat to the story. Jeff Widener had run out of film and was fortunate enough to have secured a role from a tourist. That was the film used for the Tank Man photo. Now on VOA Asia, in the 30 years since the Tiananmen Square incident, China's government has systematically suppressed any discussion or mention of the event. News reports on that day were instantly beamed around the world. Because of the clampdown of information inside China, stories from people directly involved remain quiet secrets. Journalist Louisa Lim spent 10 years in China reporting for the BBC and for the U.S.-based National Public Radio. Lim took extraordinary precautions to tell some of these stories in her book, The People's Republic of Amnesia.
People who were involved in the events, they're growing old, and their stories are not being told. I thought about it for so long, and I thought, well, if I don't write this book, who will write this book? So I really hope that this book will really, in some ways, reopen the discussion about how history is treated and how people in China have gone along with the government and how this whole sense of national identity that has been created is actually riding on the back of, in many ways, history which is false.
Tell me a little bit about some of these interviews that you conducted and some of the logistics involved in speaking with these people. It's a very sensitive topic.
It is a very sensitive topic. And several of the people who I interviewed were under various forms of surveillance because of their past. There was one woman called Zhang Xianling, 76 years old. She is the co-founder of a group called the Tiananmen Mothers. Her 19-year-old son died in 1989. He died from one bullet to the head when he tried to take a picture of the martial law troops. The first time I went to visit her, when she opened the door to me, the very first words that she said were, "I had a telephone call from the police this morning and they knew you were coming." I think she summed it up best when she said to me, something along the lines of, "Isn't it amazing that the state can be so worried about a little old lady like me?" It shows how powerful we are, these group of old people, because we represent righteousness, and the state knows that, and that's why they're scared of us.
Did you get any sense through your interviews that at some point in time, the government may open up a little bit about this issue, or are they just content to let it disappear into the fog of history?
There was hope before Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang took power that this might happen. But in fact, very early on, Xi Jinping signaled that, you know, not only was 1989 not up for discussion, but actually anything that happened even during the reign of Chairman Mao, none of that was up for discussion. When I started doing this book, and I just wanted to find out how much young people knew about 1989, I went to some of Beijing's top universities and I took the picture of Tank Man, the man standing in front of the line of tanks, and I asked 100 students if they could tell me when and where this picture was taken, and I was really surprised that only 15 out of 100 could place the picture as being taken in China. And that really made me think that the Chinese government's been very successful at, you know, deleting this memory and making sure that young people, they're just not interested in politics. They don't seek out that kind of information because they know that it could be dangerous.
Louisa Lim, correspondent for the BBC and the U.S.-based National Public Radio, speaking to us about her book, The People's Republic of Amnesia, published by Oxford University Press. You'll find our full VOA Asia program on the 30th Tiananmen Square anniversary on our website, voanews.com, along with many other stories, photos, videos, interviews about the incident and its legacy. We thank you for listening to VOA Asia today. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Nelson Lopes, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook.
I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day.